Hello, everyone, and welcome to our podcast, Stained Glass Stories. We just finished going through the story of Noah and the Great Flood. So now it's time, as always, to reflect on what we've read. So we're going to discuss some interesting topics that we didn't have time for during the previous episode. So my name is Josh Green.
And my name is David Dominguez.
Let's get started.
All right, so we just finished looking at the story of Noah, and one of the things that we have highlighted in previous episodes has been this parallel between stories as we cover them. This is especially noticeable in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. For example, we saw how both Adam and Cain had sinned, were judged, then exiled, and had moved east. Right? So we saw these parallels between those two stories. And with that in mind, we wanted to point out some parallels between the story of Adam and Noah. So I'll start with the first one. One of the first parallels that we see is that, like Adam, Noah is given authority over the animals. And some even make the connection that just as Adam took care of animals in the garden, Noah took care of animals in a floating garden, since the ark was made of wood.
Oh, clever.
Yes, and we don't want to take that connection too far, but what is clear is that in both stories, God is entasking humanity to partake in his work with him. Furthermore, both Adam and Noah are blessed by God and are told to be fruitful and multiply. We see this in Genesis 1 and in Genesis 7. With these parallels in mind, we start to understand that the author wants us to see Noah as a new Adam.
That's good. But the parallels don't end there. We see sin in both stories exposes nakedness, right? Adam and Eve realize they are naked after eating from the tree, and Ham's sin is described as seeing his father's nakedness. Not just in that case, but in both stories, nakedness is covered by another. In the case of Adam and Eve, God provides clothing with the sacrificial animal. And in the case of Noah, his two other sons, Shem and Japheth, cover his nakedness.
And while we're talking about sin, there's more parallels there because the results of the sin in both stories are also similar. As in, they result in a curse on posterity, and they lead to ongoing conflict between the seeds. And last but not least, in both stories, it doesn't just end with punishment and, you know, consequences. There is a promise given by God that signals redemption that is to come. Adam and Eve are promised one who will crush the head of the snake. And Noah is promised that the world will never be destroyed again by water.
And so really, we just bring all this up to recall this big picture narrative within all of Scripture, but how the same themes and parallels and ideas that were perpetuated through Adam and Eve into Cain are once again showing up in the story of Noah. So there's a common thread here. And we're going to keep track of it as we continue to read.
Yes.
Now, staying in line with this general chronology of Genesis, we will briefly touch on this curiosity that we addressed earlier on in the genealogies of Adam, right before we read of the flood. So, again, before we get into the flood, we see that Adam and his ancestors were living for nearly 1,000 years, each of them. And we asked, what would that have even looked like? And certainly, why do we not even live that long anymore? And I still don't have the answers to those questions.
Come on, Josh.
I know. I would venture to say nobody does, but I'll provide a fun fact about the genealogies that may speak to the validity of these years being literal years and not strictly figurative. And we'll start with this question to get our minds turning. Were Noah's ancestors still alive after the flood started? So, kind of a weird question, but they lived for so long. Maybe there's a contradiction in the math of these genealogies. So let's look. So this is all according to the timeline provided in chapter 5, if you want to reference it. Because, like I said, if they've all been living for hundreds of years, it seems possible that one of them could have been alive when the flood started. Now, stay with me. There's a lot of math that's about to go down. It's basic addition, but...
Oh, thank goodness.
Yes, but it could still be hard to follow. So, per chapter 7, we saw that the flood began when Noah was 600 years old. And we know that Lamech, who is Noah's father, he was 182 years old when he had Noah. So, if we add 600 years to that, Lamech would have been 782 years old when the flood started.
Okay, I can follow that math.
So we're at the first father. Okay, we're doing the math here at Lamech. But actually, we read that he died at 777 years old. So that's 5 years beforehand, 5 years before the flood started. So Lamech, we're good. He's already passed away. And interestingly, some speculate that Noah began building the ark around this time. There's no biblical justification for that, but that's what some people believe. But Methuselah, okay, we read of Methuselah, and he lived to be 969 years old.
Wow.
That's got to be close, right?
Yep.
And that's longer than Lamech, his son. So where does he land? Well, Methuselah was 187 years old when he fathered Lamech, and he lived 782 years after that. That means that he outlives Lamech by 5 years, right? Because Lamech lived 777 years after he was born, and Methuselah lived 782 years after Lamech was born. That means that Methuselah died in the same year that the flood started.
Wow.
Wow. So, in conclusion, both Lamech and Methuselah died before the flood began. And Methuselah actually died in the same year that the flood began.
That is crazy.
Wow. Wow.
Wow.
And I don't know if this is as interesting to the listener as it was to me, but I kind of just stumbled upon this after my mind went there and decided to run the numbers. Simple addition, but fun nonetheless. And the math checks out. How about it?
Yeah, that's super interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, we've got a lot more to talk about, so let's move on. Immediately after the genealogies of Adam, we arrive in chapter 6 of Genesis. So let's talk about that.
All right, so... Chapter 6. This is a very, very interesting section of the story because the first four verses of Genesis 6 are some of the most confusing and talked about verses in the Old Testament. During our regular episode, we stuck to the things that these verses showed that were directly related to the story of Noah and the Great Flood. Basically, that the growth of humanity was being paralleled to the growth of their wickedness. We did this to avoid getting too off topic and losing the main idea of the story. But having said that, we thought it would be good to explore what the main interpretations of these verses are during a reflection episode. And here we are. Much like our deep dive into the story of the curse of Canaan, there are also three major views with regards to who are the sons of God and the Nephilim in this passage. So we're going to explore these three most prominent views. And right off the bat, I want to give credit to Meredith Klein, who is a dude.
Oh, Meredith.
Yes. And he wrote an article that he titled Divine Kingship and Genesis 6, 1 through 4, which is exactly the verses that we're going to be talking about. And it was a great resource to me. Now, obviously, the title of his article shows what his position was with regards to these verses. But within the article, he explores all three major views. And so our scope, while we go through these three major interpretations, is not to be exhaustive by any means, but instead gloss over the main views, list out strengths and weaknesses of each position, and then let you, the listener, dig deeper and reach your own conclusions.
Yep, that's our format. That's what we do. So before we get started, let's go ahead and read verses 1 through 4 again. So we're in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. Now it came about when men or mankind began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them. And the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. So then the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old men of renown. We wanted to note that some scholars don't think the narrative demands that the Nephilim are the byproduct of the union depicted in Genesis 6. Rather, that the small section about the Nephilim is just another piece of information to kind of create a historical point. However, most scholars do agree that the Nephilim were the offspring, because if not, the text order wouldn't really make sense in their opinion. So having said that, disconnecting the verse is not out of the realm of possibility, but to most, it seems unlikely. So let's begin to try to answer our main question. Who were these sons of God?
Yeah, and let's jump right into the first and what used to be the most common view. It's no longer the most common interpretation, but that is the Sethite view. And within this first interpretation, the sons of God are the Sethites, and the daughters of man are Cain's descendants, okay? And this was, like I said, initially the most common interpretation of the passage, and it does have some strengths, right? The theme of the preceding context, right before Genesis 6, so chapters 4 and 5, what they basically do is they parallel the two family lines of Seth and Cain and contrast them. Right, so it's not too outlandish to make this connection and say, well, then maybe chapter 6 is also talking about that contrast between these two lines. However, there are still some weaknesses to that view, right? Like at face value, you're like, yeah, that could make sense. But there are some issues. So for example, like Josh just read, the word humankind in verse 1, where it says, when man began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, that is a very general term in verse 1. And in this scenario, you would have to assume that man or mankind, the word there is ha Adam, right? That word would have to be referring to men who were having children or daughters who were from the line of Cain. It has to kind of be a more narrow definition than probably what you assume when you first read that verse. And so many have tried to kind of fix this or make sense of it by just saying that the term is just referring to generic humanity, and that in both verses, it just means, you know, generic humanity was growing and generic humanity was having more daughters, and that the Sethites, who are the sons of God, were marrying with women from either their line or the line of Cain, kind of not really choosing one over the other, but were intermingling. They were marrying women from the line of Cain, which apparently is what's wrong with this view. This is the sin of Genesis 1 through 4, is that men from the line of Seth were marrying women from the line of Cain. That's what they view as the issue here, right? But there's that becomes a weakness, because the text doesn't really distinguish Seth's line as children of God, and it doesn't distinguish Cain's line as not being that, right? So we don't get that anywhere else in chapters 4 or 5. And not to stop there, there is nowhere in the previous chapters where we see scripture saying that Seth's offspring were told to not marry daughters from Cain's line. So there's just a lot of things we kind of have to assume that has been set in place for this to be the issue with Genesis 6, 1 through 4. And lastly, this term, the Nephilim, which is the offspring of this mixed marriages, doesn't really make a lot of sense because the mixing is just between two lines, right?
It's still coming from Adam and Eve.
Correct. It's still two human lines having an offspring that we're now calling the Nephilim as a descriptor or a distinctive, but there really seems to be no distinction there. And so because of these like questions that arose, a second interpretation of the passage has kind of taken its place as the most common interpretation among scholars. So I'll let you start with that one, Josh.
Yeah, so the second view is the idea of the sons of God being fallen angels. As David said, this is probably the most common view among scholars currently, and it's the whole idea that the sons of God are divine beings and the daughters of man were just human women. So basically, angels came down and they slept with women somehow, right? References within the book of Enoch and in the rest of Old Testament kind of help support this view. So we see sons of God referring to angels in the book of Job and other Old Testament texts, including Deuteronomy 32 and then 8 through 9, and then in Job 1:6 and 38:7. We see this kind of idea of sons of God being angels. Now, proponents of this view also reference the fallen angels in 1 Peter and Jude as being the same angels that we see in this story. And, of course, this interpretation solves two major issues with the first interpretation. It would explain why the offspring of this union would be different or not fully human, right? Speaking of the Nephilim. And it would make it to where the term for humankind, Ha-Adam, in verses 1 and 2, referred to the same kind of humankind or mankind, having more daughters, more human daughters, instead of having to assume that man is having more daughters through Cain's line. So it removes this distinction between Seth and Cain entirely. Having said that, there are still some weaknesses to that view. So David, help us out here.
Yeah, so very, very similarly, the immediate context just tells us nothing that would lead to this interpretation, right? Chapter 6 specifically is littered with words like man and flesh continually appearing, especially in verse 3, where then the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh, right? So that terminology, it just makes it seem like what's going on is something between humans, flesh, right?
Not angels.
Right. And so another weakness is that while, yes, the term sons of God is used to describe angelic beings in Job, and I think you pointed Deuteronomy, and even in the book of Enoch, we also see it used in Psalm 82, okay? And in Psalm 82, it's actually describing rulers, human rulers, kings, right? And while it can be suggestive, you can say we see it oftentimes used to describe angels, we can't say it's conclusive because we also see it in other texts used to describe human beings, okay? And when we look at Psalm 82, this is kind of where Klein pushes back on people who take this interpretation. We see that angels are being punished, that they are judging and ruling over humanity, and that they are dying. If we're taking this interpretation, that is what we're seeing happen in Psalm 82. The issue is nowhere in Scripture do we see a support of that, right? Like who rules, who rules either justly or unjustly over mankind and eventually dies? Kings, right? So Psalm 82, the point that Klein is making is if you read Psalm 82 and you are thinking this is referring, the reference to sons of God is referencing angels, then you're ignoring what the rest of Scripture tells us about angels. Clearly, Psalm 82, according to Klein, is a reference to human kings who rule either justly or unjustly, are judged, and they will eventually die.
Yeah, which then obviously transitions us into the third and final view, which through reading this, you'll understand that this is Klein's conclusion, right? So, David,
one last thing before we jump into the last one.
Yeah.
And this is really, really, I think, probably the weakness that for me was like, oh, this doesn't quite add up in my mind, is that we just read the story of Adam and Eve in chapter 3. And what happened in their story when they sinned with an angelic being? All three of them were addressed and judged by God, right? Both Adam, Eve, and the serpent.
Yes.
In this story, there is no mention of judgment to said angelic beings. Right after this, we go into the story of the flood, and it's referencing the wickedness of mankind. Nowhere does it make any reference to angelic beings. And according to the setup that we just saw in chapter 3, we should expect, if these are angelic beings, we should expect them to be addressed by God. And right. We just don't see that.
There should be consequences.
Yes. But to Josh's point, Psalm 82 is one of the weaknesses, and then it ends up being kind of where Klein makes his stand to lead to the third view, which is that the sons of God were ancient kings whose sin, in verses 1 through 4, was the practice of polygamy. Okay? And so, basically, kings who took women as they pleased. And so I'll go through some of the strengths, and I'll let you talk about some of the weaknesses of this view, because as we're going to quickly find out, all of these interpretations have some strengths to them, and they also have some weaknesses. So the biggest strength of this argument is it lies within the Near Eastern life and culture. And this is what Klein kind of like cites a lot in his article. Within this culture, kings were often regarded in one sense or another as being divine. They were called sons of the various gods. So Klein points to like specifically an old epic of the time where the king is referenced as the son of God or the son of El, just like in this passage. And so he uses this cultural background to make the case, along with Psalm 82, that kings are oftentimes referenced to as sons of God. And then when we look at the rest of Scripture, where we see that, you know, God clearly speaks of kings as being appointed by him, put in place to judge and rule. God appoints kings, takes down kings. We see this language that kind of leads us to not just see the link in Psalm 82 as being a reference to kings, but then also seeing the possibility of the reference in Genesis 6 as being kings as well. And now, to kind of make sense of this position, within this view, the offspring would be men. Son of these kings would be like their fathers, men who only cared about themselves and growing their name. This theme would make sense with the pattern that we see in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, where humanity's attempt to grow their own name leads them away from fellowship with God. And so Klein points to people like Cain and how he dedicated his city to the name of his heir as a foreshadow to the lust for a name that was increasingly to mark these cities' rulers. We see this in verse 4, where they're, you know, men of the name or of renown. Klein also points to Lamech, not the father of Noah, but the Lamech from the line of Cain, who was kind of an example of this in Genesis 4, where we saw that he took wives, bore children, and used them as dynastic exploits. So in this final interpretation, the sin was not a mixture of two worlds, like in the angelic view, or of two religious communities, as in the Sethite view, or even of two social classes. There were some old Jewish views of this where they just interpreted it as rich people marrying poor people. But instead, the sin was that of Lamech, the sin of polygamy. And so it also answers a pretty large question from the story, and that is, how are the Nephilim still alive after the flood? Well, if they were just the offspring of polygamous kings, then that would make sense, right? Because theoretically, polygamous kings or children of kings who had this same mindset that were just about their name existed well after the flood.
Right. It's a generic term assigned instead of a specific people at that time.
Correct. So it would solve that issue.
Mm. Okay. So just as a general summary, right? When it talks about sons of God, we're talking about kings. We're not talking about angels. We're not talking about anything else. We're talking about human beings.
Right.
And the sin is that they're marrying the daughters of mankind. But it's not the fact that they're marrying them, it's that they're marrying them at a large volume, which is, as David reiterated, the sin of Lamech, polygamy. Okay, so what are the weaknesses? Right, that seems reasonable. That seems like a pretty strong case. Well, the biggest problem is, honestly, just the fact that it doesn't refer to them as kings at all.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say it. So we are definitely extrapolating some data, if you will, when we call them kings and we derive this entire interpretation off of that. There is that singular liberty that we take, or rather that Klein takes, that if you acknowledge that as a possibility, it's a pretty fair interpretation. If you don't think that's a fair translation of these sons of God, then you're obviously going to take issue with it.
Right.
So there you have it. Those are the three major interpretations of this fairly confusing portion of scripture. If you read through it without having these interpretations, you're probably even more confused. So hopefully we were able to shed some light on it and potentially pique your interest, which may lead to further discussion or study of this topic, if you so desire. So when we transition from this initial part of Genesis chapter 6, we see this sinful behavior result in God wanting to bring wrath on a humanity that has rejected his commands,
mm-hmm.
right? So that leads us to ultimately the flood. Now, what's interesting is we've already gone through and we've talked about it and talked about the implications of the flood story on scripture. But the Judeo-Christian flood story is not the only flood story that we have
right.
in recorded history, right? Some of you may know that there are many other, in fact, hundreds of flood stories documented throughout various civilizations, and most major religions have their own flood story, including Islam, Hindu, Buddhism, as well as other civilizations such as the Akkadians, Babylonians, Sumerians, Egyptians, the Greeks, the Norse, in their mythology. Even Hawaiians have their own flood story, and the list just seems to continue to go on and on, and you can check out our show notes for reference. But most of these include the concept of an ark, even.
Mm.
And this ark delivering a small portion of the population. And I find this very interesting because there seems to be a universal understanding or common knowledge of a massive flood destroying large groups of people. So what does this mean? Well, I'll tell you what conclusions I've drawn from it, and you can feel free to do your own research into these flood stories and let us know what you think. But I think it's fair to conclude that in almost every major culture having their own flood story, it likely means that it's true to some extent that some kind of universal flood truly occurred, and the generations that followed the flood would have spread this story to their ancestors as they spread across the globe. Now, these stories are all very different from each other and most lack any significant connection to Noah specifically, but you know, it's possible over time as the stories have passed down orally or in written form, I think it would make sense if the details were adjusted over time to fit the language and culture of respective countries or religions. Who knows? But it certainly is interesting that we have a common story throughout humanity, something that we all seem to share.
Yeah, something that I just wanted to add to that. I know I haven't read as many of the stories as you have. You kind of did a deep dive on this, which I thought was really interesting to hear from. But you know, as I read like three specific ones, and I have to find the specific article, but it was something that highlighted to me kind of this contrast where there was a lot of similarity. But one of the things that I think makes the story in the Old Testament stand out, and I wouldn't say stand out from all, but I would say stand out from most, and I would say most of the flood stories, the deity that is enacting judgment is not really providing a way of redemption or deliverance for humanity. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are some that have that same, you know, story arc, but in a lot of the ones that I read, it was like either humanity trying to trick the deity or a lesser deity tricking the major deity, right, and saving, sure, humanity. So I just thought it was interesting how, you know, in the Old Testament story, we see God not just as the enactor of judgment, but we also see him as the provider of deliverance. You know, Noah's not trying to outsmart God. God is actively giving him instruction of how to be delivered. So just an interesting point that I saw.
Yeah, and there's going to be an even deeper connection that we're going to draw of what God's deliverance looks like in his perspective on humanity. But we'll get to that in a second. So the other thing that we've mentioned before, specifically in our Adam and Eve reflection episode, we talked about how the Canaanite creation story has the contrast of the god of the sea, Yam. Remember, Yam is the Hebrew word for sea. Mm-hmm. And how he battled against Baal, the god of thunder and rain and the mighty rider of the clouds. Well, we discovered that Baal defeated Yam. So not only with the Canaanites, but also the Babylonians, they have a very similar story. In the famous Babylonian creation story, Enuma Elish, the god Merodach defeats the goddess Tiamat, who represents the sea. So same idea. This brings up this concept of cosmic battle, a battle of good and evil represented by God's dominion over the waters. So once again, in this flood narrative, we see that not only did God create the waters, but he can control them however he desires, whether it is the flooding of the earth, or again, like we mentioned, when Jesus rebukes the waves and calms the storm, God is in control over the evil of the earth. And what I think is important to note here is that once again, God does not desire to destroy his creation, but must bring order to the utter chaos that has been perpetuated by evil people. So whether you believe it's the fallen angels or the evil kings who are practicing polygamy, there's utter chaos, and God is going to restore it, just as he did with Adam and Eve, right? So what does he do? Interestingly, God sort of releases chaos back into the world, undoing the separation of waters that we saw in Genesis chapter 1, and causing the waters to once again cover the whole earth. And God answers the evil deeds by unleashing chaos again, right? And resetting humanity to once again bring order to the world. Almost ironic in the sense that God uses chaos to bring order because we brought chaos into his order, right? Almost a paradox, but the story doesn't end there. We see that God has made a covenant with Noah, and he promises Noah in chapter 9 that he will not destroy the earth again through the flood. And this is where things start to get really interesting. What sign does he use to represent the covenant?
Yeah, he uses a bow in the sky. And we have already covered a lot of material, but as usual with these recap episodes, we want to wrap up this reflection by connecting this story to the greater theme or tapestry of Scripture, which is God's plan of redemption for mankind through the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. Now, the promise given by God to Noah was in the form of a bow, and it is a potential foreshadow of redemptive hope that is ultimately fulfilled with Jesus. Of note, the word for bow in the story is the same Hebrew word for bow as in bow and arrow. as we had discussed in the previous episode. What is interesting is that the rainbow is being placed on the earth by God, and it is facing where? Towards the heavens. You may ask, why is it facing towards the heavens? Well, some individuals explain this symbolism to mean the destruction the earth deserves is now no longer pointing at us, but rather at God.
Wow.
As a destructive weapon, the bow points at God, and we see that he is the one who will receive the wrath that mankind deserves.
Yeah, and as we continue to read in Scripture, we understand that Jesus is the bow or judgment that should have been aimed at us. There's always a consequence for our sin. There always has to be some sort of wrath satisfied. But instead of the judgment being cast toward us as it was with the flood, now this bow represents that it is instead being pointed or aimed at him. So we are therefore promised forgiveness and sonship by the ransom of his blood. The wrath of God has been satisfied by Jesus, who took on the sins of the world and died the death we deserved. It's crazy.
Wow.
I love that. I love that. And I actually first heard that through the Bama podcast, and it's been reiterated by other individuals, but I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
Not everyone interprets the bow to symbolize the coming of the Messiah, but I think it's consistent with Scripture and perpetuates the same themes that we've already seen in the story of Adam and Eve, with the offspring bringing that promise of reconciliation. And again, it's fascinating to watch the Old Testament story unfold and reveal the necessity of a Messiah. And again, provide subtle hints such as the bow as to who that Messiah will be. So we've just given a kind of brief recap of the flood narrative while digging deeper into some of the subjects that are more speculative. Mm-hmm. And it's been a lot of fun. It's been very interesting kind of digging deeper into some of these ideas, hopefully making a little bit more sense to some of these very odd stories or bits and pieces of this passage that just don't seem to make sense with our modern Western view. So thank you for joining us on our grand adventure through the story of Noah and the flood. Tune into our next episode where we unpack the story of the Tower of Babel, or Babel. Thanks to Charles Spears for the music and Victor Paez-Lemay for the mixing and editing. We'll see you in the next one. Thank you.